Please support the Climate Change and Happiness podcast. See the donate page at climatechangeandhappiness.com.
Welcome to Climate Change and Happiness, an international podcast that explores the personal side of climate change, your feelings, what the crisis means to you, and how to cope and thrive. And now, your hosts, Thomas Doherty and Panu Pikkala.
Well, hello, I'm Thomas Doherty.
And I am Panu Pikkala.
And welcome to Climate Change and Happiness, our podcast. This is a show, a podcast for people who are thinking and feeling deeply about climate change and other environmental issues and how this figures into our daily lives and how we cope and thrive. And we have this provocative idea that we should explore what happiness means in the modern world. Panu and I have been talking about teachers and teaching. And we should be all hearing this episode in the summer of 2024, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, and folks maybe on their winter breaks in the Southern Hemisphere. So thinking about teachers, many of whom at this time might be taking some time off and reflecting on their work. So, there's a new resource for teachers that we want to talk about. So Panu, do you want to get us launched into this conversation?
Definitely, and with warm respect to all teachers and educators, and me and Thomas having done our part of teaching and at least adult education also ourselves, there's a lot to talk about. And the focal point today will be a new book edited by Jennifer Atkinson and Sarah Chakvet-Ray called The Existential Toolkit for Climate Justice Educators, and then the subtitle, How to Teach in a Burning World. Mm-hmm. The cover is quite striking, yellow background, then a red question mark with a burning planet. It has visual similarity to Sarah's book, Field Guide to Climate Anxiety, and there's a nice episode of our podcast where we discuss with Sarah, so please check that out, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes also. But now this new book has come out. Its aim is to help teachers and educators to deal with these complex issues that are going on in the world. So climate change is the main topic, but of course that's linked with lots of democracy issues, various social and ecological issues. So there's a lot to cover here. And the idea in the book was to have relatively short chapters and include voices from diverse backgrounds. And so there's 37 short chapters dealing with various topics. And I hope this doesn't sound overwhelming. They are not overly long. And I also wrote one, and we can return to that later. The history of this book goes back to a project led by Ellen Kelsey, another guest in our podcast episode, and Jennifer and Sarah, called The Existential Toolkit for Climate Justice Educators. So first there was a project which had an online conference that was supposed to be on site in Germany, but then COVID-19 came, and it developed into an international network. So that's the history of the book.
Yeah, and that's I remember that conference, and yes, my goodness, bringing us back into COVID. When Panu and I were doing our planning, the shadow of COVID wasn't actually mentioned, and now it puts a lot of this work into context. And of course, teachers know, and we're still dealing with the fallout of the COVID pandemic and how that I guess revolutionized and teaching in various ways for good or for bad. And just in general, it speaks to how COVID really changed projects and changed people's plans and kind of extended. I'm sure Jennifer and Sarah wanted this book to come out. I know as a writer myself, you want your material to come out as soon as possible. So I'm sure they've been nurturing this and feeling the long game with this book. It was held up by COVID, and then it turned into a slightly different project. Had some innovation was needed. Let's just take a moment to remember how COVID upset our lives. People are moving forward, but it's something to remember and just to give ourselves some grace about, because it did change a lot of things in the short term. So Panna, you've been a teacher in more of a university level, right? With young adults and adults.
Yeah, in the recent years, that's the history. And for me, it goes back to my childhood family. My mother did her daily job as a teacher in what we call comprehensive school in Finland, and specializing in English. And as a young boy, I was running at the corridors of the local school. So the school spaces were very sort of familiar and safe for me because of that reason. And then when I started doing some work, I worked as a substitute teacher in various schools. So I began with smaller kids and did one longer period of several months teaching fifth graders, but then moving more to teaching and educating young people and then young adults at the university level. And that has led me to a sort of special relationship with environmental education also. And like I've talked in some of our previous episodes, that is intimately connected with my eco-emotion work also, because that's the context where that came up for me in the collaboration with environmental educators and people working in that sphere. And I know, yeah, Thomas, that you've been teaching at university level, so do you regard that as the sort of main aspect of your teaching, or how do you see that?
It's interesting to think. I mean, we could all think about the role of education in our lives. You're reminding me of my childhood. So I grew up in Buffalo, New York, in Western New York State, and I went to Catholic schools. So Catholic elementary school, Catholic high school, and had a lot of good, really solid, basic teaching in those settings. Education is unique in my life because I'm the first person in my family to go to higher education, to go to college and graduate school. And my parents did not attend college. So that was an interesting rite of passage for me. I considered actually being a teacher and getting a teaching degree immediately after college and didn't go into teaching, but I did end up working with young people. And interestingly enough, I was interested, because I'd gone to college in New York City, I thought that one possible life path would be to be teaching in an inner city school in New York City. So it was actually my rationale to start working with kids in the juvenile justice system and come out west and doing these outdoor programs as a test to see if I wanted to work with these tough kids in these tough urban environments. But of course, my life was actually led into the outdoors through that. And through my work as a psychologist and doing eco-psychology and climate work, I started teaching at Lewis and Clark Graduate School, and went from one class to creating a certificate program at the graduate level there for the College of Education and Counseling there. So I became a university-level educator. So I have a sense of that world as well. And also the challenge of creating a new program in academia and navigating all the academic politics at the university level. And of course, I received my doctorate in clinical psychology. So I have that experience as well of going to graduate school. And interestingly enough, as part of my early career postgraduate from my clinical program, while I was getting settled and finishing my residency in Oregon, I worked as a school psychologist in an elementary school here in Portland, in a school that was primarily made of immigrant young people. And so my job was being a school psychologist. So you're looking at special education and that kind of thing. So I have, it's interesting to think I've touched in on teaching, and I really do enjoy teaching and I enjoy the public speaking aspect and the group facilitation aspect of teaching, and a big part of my approach, even in this podcast and in my work and writing, is educational, you know, giving people information. So I can feel the teachers, and I, of course, in my practice have worked with a lot of teachers at various levels, so I've seen the inside of the teacher's world as well.
Yeah, that's very interesting to hear. I knew some of that, but not all of that. So always interesting to learn more, and we definitely share that interest to and methods where people can engage with the topics in various ways. So not just one person speaking all the time, but encouraging people to participate and communicate with each other. And for me, a special influence for that was the Finnish confirmation school system, which is a sort of Nordic speciality, and even Finland among the Nordic countries has some special features in that. It's still very popular. About 90% of 15-year-olds go to these confirmation school camps in conference centers or camp centers, usually next to a lake or a wood. And it's a sort of rite of passage, not so strictly as it used to be, but it's a kind of liminal space in the sense that you go outside the everyday, ordinary life with other youngsters, and you spend time thinking about deep issues of life. And that's what I did first as a volunteer youth leader, and then as a sort of youth worker, and later on when I worked in a congregation as leading those camps, and it greatly shaped my approach to education and so-called pedagogy also. And it has interesting links to then later work with ego emotions and some retreats and that sort of thing, and has also many connections with the book we have in our hands.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, we titled this episode for teachers. So we're doing that specifically to honor, you know, listeners out there that are teachers. I know there's many listeners that are teachers at various levels and various contexts, and just to honor your work, because it's difficult, needed work that's often unappreciated and unrewarded or under-rewarded. And seemingly constantly under threat of various reasons. I know right now in the United States, there's a lot of politicization of schooling, and politicization of books and reading list. And that does turn up the heat in the classroom regarding climate change. So I think the chapters in this existential toolkit, you know, are really helpful. We've got other people that have been on our podcast, like Leslie Davenport, talking about just the whole emotional approach to talking about these issues in a classroom. And teachers are under a lot of stress to give accurate information to their students about the state of the world, which can be quite troubling. The special term is pedagogy or pedagogical, which is, you know, your philosophy of teaching and your methods of teaching. But there's a pedagogical, you know, challenge to bring all this information in without really scaring particularly young students or turning them off. So Christy Manning and another colleague of ours, she has a chapter on an emotional impact statement and people talking about hope. So it is challenging, much like therapists, that the teachers are also experiencing this themselves, all these issues. So they have to make sense of it themselves. They have to hold space in the classroom. They have to try to inspire students. So it's a hard job. It's a hard job. And this is in terms of ideas and teaching methods and information, but literally dealing with weather and heat and smoke, if it's affecting the local environment, or dealing with students that are dealing with disasters. We have schools that are affected by disasters. COVID was a broad example, but, you know, we're talking about fires, floods, smoke, any climate disaster. We don't often think about that in the news or in our theorizing about climate change, but climate disasters affect education. They affect schools. They disrupt kids' learning. They physically take kids out of schools. Schools might be actually physically destroyed. So there's a deep social justice piece here, especially when we leave the US or Finland and go to other places, the global South, Central Africa or India, Bangladesh. You know, I think education is almost a unacknowledged casualty of climate change.
Profound array of impacts, and it's very intersectional. Lots of factors affect each other, and I know that for many educators and teachers, it can feel challenging to start explicitly discussing topics like climate change because they are so big and difficult. One of the strengths and resources is that educators already have many skills which can be applied also to these topics. Mm-hmm. And then there's some more general challenges or needs for development like trauma-informed education, which are related not only to climate change but also other kinds of stress and trauma. So there's that kind of overlap between various topics, and that shows also in the book. So being trauma informed is one major theme, and justice issues are a very big theme, and that of course reflects also earlier work by Sarah Chakravarty and Jennifer Atkinson and by many contributors to this book. It starts with Blanche Worley writing about a pedagogy for emotional climate justice. Mm. So topics of emotions and justice are deeply intertwined from the beginning of the book.
Yeah, there's so many overlaps with the therapy world that I spend time in. There's a question of how much to bring in the political realm into the classroom, and is the classroom a place outside of politics, kind of a safe space to discuss things in a more neutral way, or do you need to really push on certain issues or certain kinds of advocacy? And of course, it really depends on where you're teaching, and with some students, it's really raising awareness of privilege and how good students have it, and dealing with their guilt and feelings of shame, and then of course the whole trauma-informed approach, which is kind of another therapy catchphrase that we use, and people don't know what that means. But it simply means understanding that people have background issues that could include physical injury or mental health injuries that are affecting them in the present world. And acknowledging that,
you know, Thomas, that very, very theme is much discussed in the part 5 of the book, which deals with discomfort and difficult knowledge. There are some educational thinkers who especially have engaged with this sort of pedagogy of discomfort, meaning topics which are difficult and cause discomfort, and there's too with a lot of privilege, and of course doing that ethically and wisely. But the guilt dynamics and the difficult balance between individual and collective and structural responsibility and guilt is discussed in chapters by Audrey Bryan and Mark Osiewicz, for example. And I think that's some of the cutting edge of this book, because there hasn't been so much written on that topic, for example.
You know, Pani, what I'm curious about is your chapter a little bit. I know you talk about, as not surprisingly, you talk about emotions, and you have a mind map and a spectrum line. What are those?
Yeah, so my chapter features two methods, mind map and spectrum line, and also some of my other work on environmental education and eco-emotions. I've proposed that a sort of three-step framework could be useful. So first, validating out loud the existence of difficult climate emotions or eco-emotions. So that would be sort of ethical requirement for teachers and educators. So regardless of whether one feels ready to go further, and regardless of what one personally feels, I'm arguing that it's an ethical responsibility to validate and recognize that these things are happening and they are present in the classrooms, and that can be very important for the students. Mm-hmm. Then, if possible, the second step would be providing opportunities to discuss climate emotions. And the third one, again, requiring more motivation and resources, would be facilitating embodied activities to encounter eco-emotions or climate emotions. Mm-hmm. And this mind map of eco-emotions is a tool for the second step. So it's a mind map activity where people intuitively, with the help of an emotion word list, write what does come to their mind about ecological crisis or climate crisis. Mm. It's very simple, but often people give the feedback that they were surprised what they ended up writing there. And this is something we have touched upon in this podcast also before. And I know, Thomas, that you use also emotion word lists in therapy settings, for example. And sometimes that can be eye-opening for people.
Yeah. Yeah, so it dovetails really with the approach that I talk about, this validate, elevate, and create. But yeah, just making space for the emotional aspects of the work is the foundational thing. And this is common sense in a way, but for many years, I know, especially in university settings, and still now, especially in more hard sciences, biology, conservation, it's very intellectual and it's very data-driven. And things have changed a lot over the last few decades, but going not that far back in time, there was literally no place for emotions in the classroom, particularly in higher education. And so you've got these people dealing with very difficult topics and no outlet. I remember years ago meeting a teacher who taught about the rainforest in the Amazon. I think he was teaching at a school in Florida, I believe. But you know, his students nicknamed him Dr. Doom because, you know, it was just the messages were so grim that they were talking about. So it was like this kind of dark humor about it. But it I've also met a number of people that were turned off from studying these topics. They were idealistic about becoming, say, an oceanographer or wildlife biologist. And then once they got into the work, it was so dry and intellectual, and there was no place to deal with the emotions. They just moved their major, so to speak. So there's kind of a quiet quitting that happens, unfortunately, with people when they get into this work, and they're not given the emotional tools. They didn't have this existential toolkit. That's I think the larger role of the toolkit is filling that gap, right? That's been missing over the years.
Yeah, I think that's very, very well put. And people have used concepts like infowhelm.
Yeah,
common tendency in environmental teaching that there's just too much difficult knowledge, and that connects with the frameworks of traumas and shocks also. And among some student groups, this has been recognized more than others. For example, there's now growing recognition for majors in environmental science that there's great need for something like existential toolkits, exactly for the reasons you are describing, Thomas. And the other method I'm discussing in the chapter, the spectrum line, is an embodied exercise where people are moving in a space in relation to one emotion word at a time in the context of ecological issues.
Yeah.
So for example, worry. If you feel environmental worry often or strongly, let your body move you more towards this end of the room, and if less so, then to the other side of the room. And of course, there's different things one must say before that, and creating a safe space and saying that, you know, you can for once try to just move as you'd like without thinking what will others think of me if I move into a certain position type of thing. And then having discussions in pairs, and then having joint discussions. So that's how I lead it. And that's something which is rare in the academia, because usually people are just sitting. Mm-hmm. But that kind of thing was very common in the confirmation school camp teaching that I grew up doing. And also the possibility to use creative methods. In the Lutheran tradition, it would be, for example, singing some songs, but also going outside or doing some visuals with crayons or other stuff. So I've seen the benefits of that from early on, and sometimes I'm frustrated about the impossibility in academia sometimes to make use of that. But people can get creative, and some people, including me also do that sometimes in academia, and there's a lot of thinking about that also in the existential toolkit book.
Yeah, no, it's great. I think a hidden superpower that you and I have is that we've done outdoor education and experiential education where you do work with groups. I mean, embodied simply means getting up and moving around and doing things rather than just sitting and taking things in passively, intellectually. So it's such a hallmark of almost anyone who's done any kind of outdoor work or team building work. experiential education is another term here in the U.S. You know, we have this summer some interesting episodes coming out, but we're talking with Will White, who has studied all this whole history of outdoor and wilderness therapy, and Ryan Reese also, who we're talking about, does experiential therapy outdoors and with fishing and psychedelic therapy and things like that. It's really great. I just did a training just a few days ago in Bend, Oregon for the local psychologist group, and many of my activities were embodied. Some of the exercises a lot of the tools I used were in keeping with the existential toolkit. I had the therapists, these are primarily young therapists that were still getting started. I had them visualize this idea of congruence in therapy, where the therapist is really in touch with their own emotions and sort of being authentic. I had them tap into where they felt the most authentic and the most congruent in their strongest sense of therapy self. And then I asked them just to imagine how it feels when someone asks them about climate change, and when someone asks them about the extinction and brings that material into the therapy room, and how that affected their sense of congruence and authenticity. And you know, what happens is therapists say, well, I lose that sense. I'm not sure how to respond. And I start to get in my head, and I'm not sure if I can respond, and I want to try to make things better, and I want to, you know, and they lose all of their skills and their presence. And so it was a really great, you know, experiential kind of way to tap into that work. And they start telling they're talking about their feelings and their inner work. And yeah, there's just many ways to do it. Even with the six Americas of climate change, the different viewpoints of climate change here in the U.S., I had signs that I'd put around the meeting room of the different groups, and rather than talking about it, I explained what they were, and then I had people go up and stand by the sign that demonstrated more of their belief, and then speak to why they chose that, and that actually adds that teaches the material more experientially than just lecturing. And then, of course, I had people randomly assigned to the group, so they had to speak from a different group, a different belief system than their own, which I've done and which I find really helpful. And people can always do it. It's really amazing how easy it is for people to go to a totally opposite value set and speak very authentically from that, because they know people, they channel people. And so it gets into just the group cohesion and getting people to talk about their feelings and also learn. You know, so this is really, you know, I think good stuff. And then teachers just need to take care of themselves. I think in the toolkit, I wonder, one of the shadow sides of teachers, as any teacher will know, is that they give and give and give and give and burn themselves out because they're always giving and maybe need to take some care of themselves. So I wonder if there's a section in the book where it's about taking care of yourself personally as a teacher.
Yes, I think that's fascinating and powerful, Thomas, what you describe from the workshops. And it also testifies to another major theme in the book, which is imagination, and using that in various ways, whether it's writing stories about futures or reading about them, and the power of play, for example, and games. So there's a lot of really interesting content in relation to that, and the need for teachers and educators to take care of themselves. I'm mentioning that in my chapter in relation to the so-called process model of eco emotions also. And it's one of these threads which runs through the book, but it's true that it might have been something to devote a specific chapter on also. So, and that's always a tricky choice, whether to make specific chapters for certain themes or to try to invite different writers to deal with that in their chapters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so shouting out to the teachers out there, you know, I hope that you all can really be taking care of yourself and building your energy. I think the existential toolkit is a nice thing to reflect on during during a break, during an off time, being thankful for all the authors that pulled that together, who, you know, are speaking from all of their places as teachers and educators. Again, as listeners, either being a teacher yourself or being a therapist or being a parent, being an educator, thinking about our own education, what we missed and what we can fill in the gaps. We can always fill in the gaps in our education. Honoring all the teachers out there in the world right now. And this is Climate Change and Happiness. You can find us at climatechangeandhappiness.com. Send us a message if you're a teacher. I'm curious about your experiences. And send us a message if you're reading the Existential Toolkit. And we'll all do our best to keep up all of our good work. Take care, Panu.
Take care, Thomas, and all listeners.
The Climate Change and Happiness podcast is a self-funded volunteer effort. Please support us so we can keep bringing you messages of coping and thriving. See the donate page at climatechangeandhappiness.com.